From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Games. You say Lakers, and I say bookmakers. I say Celtics, and you say, well, nothing rhymes with Celtics except swell tricks. Ahead on Only a Game, two longtime observers of the purple and gold and the green put the 2010 NBA Finals in historic perspective. Also, Bud Collins from the French Open, a look at this country's ailing thoroughbred tracks, and John Feinstein remembers the last time Tiger Woods was off his game. Also, the World Cup dreams, or perhaps delusions, of a certain country on the other side of the Atlantic.
You'll see the flags of St. George, all the English icons being waved around the country from the beginning of June, all through the duration of the tournament. England haven't won a major football tournament for 40-odd years. Doesn't matter, English men and women cannot get enough of backing the England team.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Having seen their team get outscored, out-rebounded, out-hustled, and out-intimidated, if there is such a word, on Thursday night, some fans of the Boston Celtics may choose to take in a movie tomorrow night rather than watch Game 2 of the NBA Championship Series. On the other hand, the Los Angeles Lakers are 15-15 in NBA Championship games overall, while the Celtics are 17-3. They've now met in the finals an astonishing 12 times. I think we may have a rivalry on our hands. Here to engage in a civil and informative conversation regarding the Lakers and Celtics are Ted Green, who blogs about the Lakers for the LA Times and is senior sports producer for KTLA Prime News. Ted, welcome to the program.
Welcome from the left coast, Bill.
Thank you. And Bob Ryan, a sports columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Bob.
Thank you. Nice to be back with you, Bill.
Let's begin with you, Ted. What did you see in Game 1 that indicates that the Lakers could very well be on their way to banner number 16?
Bill, I saw a team that was tired of getting punked in 2008. But I want to start my part of this with a disclaimer to urge Laker Nation, do not draw any broad sweeping conclusions from one victory. It's only one game. And think about the numbers 2 and 9. And those are not winning lottery numbers. I wish they were. That's a record between the Lakers and Celtics in previous 11 NBA finals. The Lakers have had their hearts broken too many times, Bobby, by your team. And, yeah. And I'm not staking out my spot on Figueroa for the parade yet.
Bob, you want to join in? Are you cautious as well?
Yes, I would say history backs up Ted's thesis. In 1984, the Lakers ran all over the Celtics in Boston in Game 1, and as we know, the eventual outcome was Boston in 7. In 1985, the Celtics had executed what is finally in Boston remembered as the Memorial Day Massacre, 148-114, lost Game 2 at home and lost the series. So you can't jump to any premature conclusions. Look, it came down to one guy. You can cut all the stuff away. Kobe Bryant's 30 points were just a product of Kobe falling out of bed. He gets 30. The difference in the game was one man, Pau Gasol. If he plays three more times like that, the Celtics will lose.
No es suave. No es soft. He's muy duro.
Y grande, además.
He's muy good, too, isn't he?
I'm regional president of his fan club, believe me. And to discuss anybody else is ludicrous. Headlines that have Bryan in them are foolish because that game was all about one man, and that one man was Pau Gasol.
I can think of many rather intense sports rivalries. USC, UCLA, Duke, Carolina, Yankees, Red Sox, Cubs, Cardinals, they all leap to mind. But these are, for the most part, regular season rivalries. Should we consider Celtics-Lakers to be the greatest rivalry in American sports?
It occupies its own unique niche. This is more like a college rivalry in that it's very, very much about culture now. It wasn't in the 60s, and the 60s was all about basketball. And now, starting with the 80s, it is now as much about the perceptions of lifestyle and attitude as it is about basketball. Would you agree, Ted?
I do, Bobby. It's also, you know, not only is it blue collar versus, you know, Hollywood plasticity, there's so much theater and so much drama in this history. It's so colorful. And it's not intra-city like USC, UCLA. It's not regional like the Yankees and Red Sox. This is a long-standing 50-year national rivalry, and I don't think there's anything like it.
Yeah, I'm sitting behind Charlize Theron. I'm spitting distance from Leo and Cruz. Stallone is sitting next to Jerry West. Across the way is Jack. On and on and on it goes. And in Boston, people say, some guy named Harry that fixes my car is there. That's just a whole different cultural thing.
I sat with him once, and he spilled beer on me.
He did.
Bob, you were on the Celtics beat starting in 1969, which is funny because earlier that year the Celtics beat the Lakers again.
Yep.
What are your favorite memories of finals between these two teams?
My favorite memory, far and away, June 4th, 1984. Game 5, 84, the so-called heat game, when the Boston Garden temperature at game time due to a raging June heat wave was 97 degrees. And Larry Bird played a transcendent game, 15 for 20 from the floor, 34.17 rebounds. Kareem was sucking oxygen on as Larry Bird was running around. That is my singular moment. That just told everything about Larry Bird and about the difference between those two teams at that point in time.
Ted, you've been covering the Lakers almost as long as Bob has been following the Celtics. You got a favorite memory for us?
It wasn't that one. I think my favorite memory has to be the following season. In 85, when, you know, you remember the junior skyhook, and finally, you know, Kareem kind of laughing. To win in Boston Garden was an epiphany for the Lakers. That was the transcendent moment in franchise history. And it really transitions into today because Kobe can never be validated as an all-time great Laker unless he gets one against the Celtics. And that's why he's on this religious quest right now. It's like a mission. Mm. Why he doesn't smile, why he's so surly, why he's as serious as a fatal heart attack. I mean, the guy is obsessed with beating the Celtics, and I don't think he's going to be denied this time. I really don't. I think this is more important to him than Boston getting another title is to the Celtics.
All right. Game 2 takes place in Los Angeles tomorrow. Ted, what do you think? How does the series go henceforth?
Celtics are going to come out hard and mean tomorrow because they know that in the 2-3-2 format, they're dead if they lose game 2. You go down 0-2, you can forget about it. They have to play really, really hard. I see an extremely close game. I think it's going to be a one-point game.
Keep your eye on number 5 for Boston. If Kevin Garnett is not going to have more physical ability than he's displayed in game 1, then there's no way the Celtics can win. That's the barometer now. He seems to be running out of gas since the Cleveland series. If he can bounce back, they have a chance. If he can't, then it will be a very short series.
Bob Ryan is a columnist for the Boston Globe, and he joined us on the line from Los Angeles. Thanks, Bob.
You're welcome, Bill.
And Ted Green blogs for the LA Times Fabulous Forum page. He also joined us from the land of 1,000 lakes. Thanks, Ted.
All right, Bill.
Laker power, Laker power. Can you feel the Laker power, Laker power? It is the hour of the Laker power. Yeah, baby, you can feel it in the air. You can feel it everywhere.
The 142nd running of the Belmont Stakes will take place today on Long Island. It's the final leg of the fabled Triple Crown, which, if there has been no Double Crown, is sometimes viewed as the red-headed stepchild, the roan, I guess I should say, of thoroughbred horse racing springtime triumvirate. As North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reports, the relatively lackluster field breaking from the gate today doesn't much help a sport that's been looking like a long shot.
Talk to people like Bob Giordano, who work in the thoroughbred horse racing industry, and you hear a growing angst that their sport is unraveling before their eyes.
This is a rally to save New York racing.
Giordano's racing advocacy group, Thoroughfan, held a protest last month here in Saratoga Springs. More than 200 people gathered outside the massive Victorian grandstand after the New York Racing Association announced that it was nearly broke. NYRA sent layoff notices to 1,400 employees and threatened to cancel this summer's meet.
The question of will there be racing needs to be settled now, not only for this year, but for the next and the ones after that.
For horse racing fans like Giordano, canceling Saratoga would be sort of like pulling the plug on the Super Bowl. On May 24th, New York's legislature stepped in, loaning the Racing Association $25 million. But Tom Lamara, editor of Blood Horse magazine, says the turmoil has industry leaders worried.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, that's a mild way to put it, but yes, I would say so, yeah.
It's not just New York State where the sport is teetering. Around the country, tracks are cutting the number of race days and slashing prize purses. Thoroughbred racing has always been an expensive proposition, and Lamara says the recession has sideswiped everybody.
It's really hard to get money to spend on horses. The banks have pulled back. The people who may invest in racehorses regularly, they don't have that kind of cash lying around anymore where, you know, you can attend a horse sale and spend, you know, $100,000 or $1 million.
In some states, the sport is already nearly extinct.
Right now, we're kind of at a crossroads where we just need a little help.
Gail Radke is one of the top horse breeders in Kansas, where earlier this month, the Woodlands Thoroughbred Track outside of Kansas City announced that the summer's meet will be canceled. The track will likely shut down for good.
That was the primary venue. That was really the only place. And people came from Illinois to race, from Iowa to race in Oklahoma when the Woodlands was up and operating.
This all seems a far cry from the glory days of just a few years ago when breeders were flush with cash and horses like Funnyside were grabbing national headlines.
And the Gutsy Gelding Funnyside has won the 129th Kentucky Derby!
That same year, a Hollywood film about Seabiscuit was in theaters across the country. But industry leaders acknowledge that the sport's long-term troubles go beyond the sour economy. Ticket sale numbers for the sport are hard to come by, but it's generally agreed that attendance has been sagging for years, and fewer people are betting on the ponies. That means the industry has come to rely on huge subsidies from trackside casinos.
To compete, we have to have those slot machines.
Scott Van Laer is a breeder who owns a thoroughbred stable just outside of Lake Placid. He says lawmakers here in New York promised a decade ago to allow a new casino at the Aqueduct Horse Track in Queens. That would have pumped tens of millions of dollars into the sport, he says, money that would have been shared with breeders and trainers. But the project got bogged down in the state legislature and the casino was never built. Then this spring, New York City's off-track betting parlors went belly up, choking off even more revenue.
Yeah, it's definitely hurt us. The question is, how many farms are going to be left operational? We've lost three of the top four breeding farms in the state are shuttered.
But the sport's growing reliance on gamblers who aren't betting on horses makes some industry leaders nervous. It's sort of like bankrolling your poker tournament with a bingo parlor. Tom Lamara with Bloodhorse Magazine says even the country's most popular and historic racing tracks risk closure without casino revenue.
I think you'll see fewer racetracks, but I wouldn't be so quick to say which ones, because the tracks with slots, they may be small market tracks, but they will continue to have the money to support horse racing.
Some racing venues in New Jersey and Pennsylvania are flourishing because of trackside slot machines. And the good news is that the trumpet will sound in Saratoga Springs next month, calling the horses to run as they have for nearly 150 years. But questions remain about the long-term financial health of this and other tracks around the country. The Thistledown track in Ohio was auctioned off last week after declaring bankruptcy. At Pimlico in Maryland, home of the Preakness, wagering was down 8% last year. For Only a Game, I'm Brian Mann.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. It's official. LeBron has decided to move on. Well, not decided exactly, since the decision was made by his handlers, who've worked a deal that will find LeBron next doing his thing in Melbourne, Florida. Fans in Akron and nearby Cleveland are predictably disheartened, since they had enjoyed visiting the big cat at the zoo. This is not a knock on Quicken Loans Arena, where the Cavaliers play, because the LeBron to which I'm referring is a Jaguar who has been shipped to the Brevard Zoo in the hopes that he'll father little cats. Whether LeBron James will follow his namesake out of Ohio remains unclear. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, England prepares to overcome injury and intimations of doom at the World Cup. But first, just over a year ago, the finalists on the women's side of the French Open faced each other at the same tournament Only that time, it was in the first round and very few people were watching. Joining me now from Paris to discuss the current French Open is Bud Collins. Bud, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, Bill and I certainly wasn't watching that first round match. That was a mystery pair.
Well, let's get into that a little bit. Samantha Stosur, one of the finalists, is ranked 7 in the world, which is about 140 or 50 slots higher than her ranking 2 short years ago. What accounts for the dramatic improvement?
She had Lyme disease for a while that kept her out and kept her unhealthy after she thought she was cured. And those things are tricky, I'm told. Anyway, she came back storming now, and what a tournament she's had to get to the final. Justine Henin, then number one, Serena Williams, despite a match point against her. And then finally, she comes up and beats Yankovic.
On the other side of the net is Francesca Schiavone, who's presently number 17 in the world. I guess it's fair to say that due to unfortunate circumstances, her semifinal match didn't exactly wear her out.
No, one set, and then Elena Dementieva, the Russian, tore a calf muscle, and that was all over. But it was for Schiavone, and it's an exciting story for her because no Italian woman has ever been in the final of a major championship. And I would say she's the longest shot of all, although she's seeded 17. They've been pumping up those seedings. I think that you could go back to 1933, Bill, a left-handed Englishwoman named Peggy Scriven won the tournament unseeded. And if those same rules had applied whenever Schiavone plays, well, she would be the longest shot, no doubt about it.
You know, talking about an Italian woman getting into the final, talking with you about tennis this way is great fun, of course, but not nearly as much fun as watching several Rome Masters matches under the sunshine at Foro Italico was a couple of weeks ago. Can we do that again next spring?
You bet. I think we should make that an annual affair even after we're dead. Somebody will prop us up.
Yeah. All right, let's get back to Paris. But on the men's side, Roger Federer is absent. It's the first time in 6 years that he has failed to reach at least the semifinals in a major tournament. Robin Soderling dismissed Federer in 4 sets. Were there any obvious reasons for Federer's troubles?
It was a wonderful match, but Roger didn't have it, and he's lost 5 matches since winning the Australian Open in January, and that is certainly non-Federer-like.
Do you expect Roger Federer to arrive rested and ready and dangerous for Wimbledon?
I think there are dangers at Wimbledon awaiting him. Once you start beating guys who are on top, everybody has a notion, well, I can do that too. And although grass is a good surface for him, Andy Roddick was very unlucky not to beat him in the final last year. Hmm.
The man who beat Roger Federer is, of course, Robin Soderling, and then he beat Tomas Berdych to reach the final. Soderling is now being touted as a guy who deserves to be mentioned in the same breath as Federer and Rafael Nadal. Is that a premature designation?
Well, we get premature with everything in sports, but no, I don't think it is in this case. He's a tremendous-looking player. He took care of Federer. Now, this is interesting in that he did Federer a favor last year. He beat Nadal in the 4th round, enabling Federer to go on to the 1 major title he hadn't held. Now, here's Soderling coming back to play Nadal again in not the 4th round, but the final, and I think it's going to be a tremendous match.
Well, in a tournament that has been full of surprises, the exception would be Rafael Nadal. He is, as you've mentioned, in the final once again. You like his chances to win, thereby displacing Roger Federer as number one in the land?
Well, I'm starting to like Soderling the way he's playing, because I was surprised when finally Nadal finished off Jürgen Meltzer in their semifinal, and Nadal barely squeezed through, tiebreaker in the 3rd set. And he looked as though he had lost his energy. That's hard to believe, but I think he's vulnerable.
All right, so you're going to go on record as Soderling winning the men's. Who wears the crown on the women's side?
I think it's Stosur. I think she's got a more complete game. But that's Schiavone. She's so much fun. You know, these 2 upsets she pulled, number 3, Wozniacki, was the biggest. She went down to the court gave it a kiss. She did that twice, and she said, this is better than spaghetti carbonara.
Red clay beats spaghetti carbonara, at least when you win.
I'm not going to try it, but it's a thought.
Bud Collins is Mr. Tennis. Need I say more? Thanks very much, Bud.
Thank you, William.
On Friday in South Africa, the World Cup tournament will begin with a match between the host team and Mexico. The whole world won't be watching, but an awful lot of it will. Perhaps the longest of the long shots in the field is New Zealand, which has been characterized by some as a collection of tradesmen off on a soccer lark. Most handicappers put the U.S. team somewhere in the middle of the pack, though a case can be made for optimism. Members of the squad have manfully said that failing to advance past the group stage this time will constitute a major disappointment. Among the more highly regarded contenders are teams from Spain, the Netherlands, Germany, and Brazil. No surprise there, eh? Also Argentina, perhaps despite the fact that they're coached by Diego Maradona, and Italy, the defending champions. Pre-tournament injuries have set the bookies to constant recalculating. Denmark's keeper Thomas Sorensen tore a ligament in his elbow a while back. Germany's Michael Ballack was ruled out with an ankle injury. Much more recently, Ivory Coast suffered the loss of Didier Drogba, whose arm was broken during a warm-up against Japan, and Rio Ferdinand suffered a knee injury during training, meaning that he's likely lost to England, which misfortune probably failed to surprise supporters of the team. England, that many-sceptered isle, that other Eden, that teeming womb of royal kings, that consistently disappointing whelp of the litter in the world's most popular sporting event. To say England, where soccer was invented, has underperformed in the World Cup is like saying BP has recently sprung a bit of a leak in the Gulf. Despite high expectations, the highly touted Brits failed to make it beyond the quarterfinals in the past two tournaments, and on some previous embarrassing occasions, they've failed to even qualify for the tournament. Back in 1950, England lost 1-0 to a team from the U.S. so thoroughly underappreciated that most people in this country didn't know the nation had sent a team to the World Cup. That game has been called the greatest upset in the history of international soccer. But, as Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports, while the Brits prepare to open against the U.S. on Saturday next, their supporters can still dream.
When Team England meets the United States next Saturday, they'll do so in the lengthening shadow of their only World Cup title. In 1966, when the U.K. hosted the tournament and the BBC broadcast its final moments.
Any second now, and here comes Hersey's back. Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over. It is now. It's four.
Since then, the Brits have managed to reach the World Cup semifinals just once and spawned no end of theories as to why the country that invented the game and brought us David Beckham in Manchester United continues to stub its toes on the world's largest soccer stage. Financial Times sports columnist Simon Cooper recently co-authored Soccernomics, which analyzes the successes and failures of teams competing for the World Cup.
England is only 50 million people, and we like to measure ourselves against, you know, Germany and France and Italy, but these are countries with a larger population, and so they tend to beat us, population being crucial, as we show in the book, for how you perform in soccer. But there are a couple of other things. One is that the best way to play soccer collectively, the best collective style, was developed in continental Western Europe. You know, around Italy, France, Germany, Holland, very porous borders, people constantly crossing the borders, spreading information to and fro, and England was a bit cut off from all that.
As a result, Cooper concludes, English soccer players stuck to their strategy of kicking the ball downfield and rushing after it, rather than using the more disciplined passing game practiced on the continent. At the Freemasons Arms, the London pub where in the mid-19th century England's governing soccer body was founded, fans like Ali Condé and Amar Salim have their own explanations for the English team's shortcomings.
They've suffered in the past from a lot of pressure, the pressure of expectation. Yeah, they play a lot of games during the English league season, so they often go to the World Cups quite tired and worn out.
Just because we've produced, you know, three or four, five, six great players doesn't necessarily mean that the teams that are going to the World Cup are necessarily good enough to win it. And I think a lot of the World Cups that we've gone to, we haven't been good enough to win it. Because the squad is the key. The squad has to have quality in depth.
Not that these deficiencies keep the English from throwing themselves into World Cup mania. David Williams, a spokesman for Ladbrokes, Britain's largest betting company, expects customers in the UK to wager nearly $2 billion on the month-long tournament.
Basically, you'll see the flags of St. George, all the English icons being waved around the country from the beginning of June, all through the duration of the tournament. It doesn't really matter how they've been performing in previous tournaments. Bearing in mind, England haven't won a major football tournament for 40-odd years. Doesn't matter. Englishmen cannot, and women cannot get enough of backing the England team.
England holds the eighth spot in the latest FIFA rankings. But recently, thanks to heavy betting on the home team, Ladbrokes' odds on England going all the way stood at just 8-1, trailing only tournament favorites Brazil and Spain. Williams notes that while English fans traditionally bet more with their hearts than their heads, this year, to his consternation, they may be onto something.
The key players for England, the likes of Wayne Rooney, the likes of Frank Lampard, Steven Gerrard, have been playing at the top of their games all season. So, if all of the 11 players, the first 11 players, turn up fit and well and can stay fit and well for the whole tournament, they do have the raw ingredients to win this World Cup. And that is not something that we've been able to say for many, many a major tournament.
Notably absent is injured team captain Rio Ferdinand, who was hoping that his third World Cup appearance would be a charm. The English team is depending instead on Manchester United's Wayne Rooney, who led the Premier League in scoring this season. But the biggest star of the 2010 squad may be its new manager, Fabio Capello. The Financial Times' Cooper says that the Italian Capello has changed the team's approach.
He has given them some more sort of Italian wisdom, how to slow a game down. Defending, you have to stand between your man and the goal. Very simple Italian rules like that. The best time to score is in the last 3 or 4 minutes, so because the opposition's tired, so you need to save some energy for that period.
England goalie Robert Green adds that Capello's attention to detail is sinking in.
The way he covers it leaves you in a really clear mind as to what needs to be done within the game, and that's how it's proved with the games that we've had and the qualifying that we've had. Won our qualifying group by some distance and looked... a really good team and a strong outfit during the qualifying campaign.
England tuned up last Sunday with a 2-1 exhibition win against 45th-ranked Japan. Green knows what's riding on England's continued success in the weeks ahead.
People have talked about it for years, and it's such a passion, such a thing that people care about so much here. It's the be-all and end-all for some people, and to win a World Cup now would be something that would change lives forever, and it's that big.
A group of English soccer broadcasters calling themselves Commentators United has even recorded a new English fight song, hearkening back to the glory days of 1966 and a celebrated hat trick in the championship game by striker Jeff Hurst.
66 gave us all our kicks, and Hurst, he had a ball.
The English are heavily favored in their opening match against the U.S. If they prevail in round one, they'll have to take on not just their next opponent, but their own checkered World Cup history. That's a sentiment echoed by American Jonathan Spector, who played for West Ham during the regular Premier League season, but will play for Team USA next week.
In this World Cup, England's really expected to win it by a lot of the public. They're at the very least seen as one of the best opportunities that the English side has had in a number of years to win the World Cup. And those are the expectations resting on the shoulders of the English players.
For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
You're listening to Only a Game. On Wednesday night in Detroit, on what should have been the final out of a baseball game involving the Tigers and the Cleveland Indians, umpire Jim Joyce made a bad call. In fact, it was a really bad call, and almost everybody in the ballpark knew it, and after the game, when he'd had a chance to watch the replay in the clubhouse, Jim Joyce knew it too.
I had a great angle on it, I had great positioning on it, I just missed the damn call.
Jim Joyce's blunder mattered more than somewhat because had he called Cleveland's Jason Donald out at first base, as he acknowledged he should have done, Detroit pitcher Armando Galarraga would have been credited with a perfect game, the first ever tossed by a member of the Tigers. Instead of celebrating that distinction, Galarraga returned to the mound and finished his job. He got the next hitter on a routine ground ball. And while players and fans roared for justice and in some magnificently stupid cases threatened Jim Joyce, Armando Galarraga, who had never before displayed the mastery apparent on Wednesday night and probably never will again, demonstrated something more important and perhaps more rare. Grace under pressure.
I know he's a human. We're all human. You know, anybody's perfect. I always expect more than a big league umpire.
The pitcher had every reason to expect more from a big league umpire, as Jim Joyce was the first to acknowledge, but he didn't get what he was entitled to expect, which happens a lot in this sweet old world, and instead of kicking his glove across the infield or surrendering his concentration in the inevitable wash of disappointment and walking the next seven batters or vowing revenge against the arbitrary gods of baseball, Armando Galarraga retained his composure, finished his day's work, and, a little later on, accepted Jim Joyce's apology for the mistake Joyce had made. Presenting professional athletes as role models is a risky proposition. There's plenty of evidence for that. But it's appropriate to acknowledge admirable behavior under difficult circumstances wherever it surfaces. Tigers third baseman Brandon Inch had that in mind when he was asked about the perfect game that wasn't. What sets that apart from anything that's happened in a long time in our sport is the absolute sportsmanship of it, he said. Galarraga and Joyce are two true gentlemen, period, in the way that they handled themselves. People will always remember that. I'll never forget it's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
Anthony Gaskill has said that he didn't mean to mislead anybody at the London Marathon. I simply walked through a shortcut to the end of the course where my belongings were waiting for me, he said. Mr. Gaskill's belongings were unavailable for comment, but the 69-year-old runner's appearance at the finish line of the marathon certainly confused the timers, who were initially prepared to celebrate him as the fastest retired competitor. Then, based on observations made throughout the race, they figured Mr. Gaskill would have had to run the last 13 miles in under an hour. This would have made him the fastest marathoner of all time, regardless of age. They would have told him to pick up his belongings and go home, but, of course, he'd already done that. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, John Feinstein looks back at the last time Tiger Woods was off his game. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Here's a fun fact. Phil Jackson's Lakers are 47-0 in playoff series in which they win the first game. That just sounds so unlikely, I can't believe it, but I guess it's true. So should the Boston Celtics just pack it up and go home after losing game one on Thursday night?
That is an astonishing stat, and I had no idea of it until the game. Look, I don't know what's going to happen in this series, but the one thing I do think is that game one is not an indication of anything. It was a terrible, ugly basketball game. There were 57-odd fouls called. There were 60-some-odd free throws taken. There was, in a 48-minute game, you didn't go a minute without a whistle. That can't happen again.
Ah, basketball.
So, in any event, I think that what game one meant, basically, is that Los Angeles is ahead 1-0.
Speaking of the NBA Finals, do you think the lure of $50 for taking a charge has motivated the Lakers to play more courageous defense?
You know, you would say no because of the amount of money these guys make, but I discovered one time I was working for GQ, about a month after he'd signed an enormous contract, we gave Stephon Marbury a free GQ hat, and you'd think we handed him the keys to Fort Knox. These guys will go for free anything, and $50 for taking a charge will actually motivate them.
Because it's a real $50.
Because it's
$50
cash.
In their hand.
It's not what your agent writes you a check for at the end of every month.
In the continuing story of the dismantlement of the Cleveland Cavaliers, GM Danny Ferry resigned yesterday. Who gets canned next? The towel boy? The equipment manager?
They're running out of guys. Regardless of what the team may say, this is in no way a mutual decision on anything. Maybe if Danny Ferry had pulled the trigger on the Amari Stoudemire trade halfway through the season, he'd still be there.
John Wooden died last night at 99. He coached men's basketball at UCLA from 1948 until 1975. Wooden's teams won 10 championships, 7 of them consecutive. He regarded himself as a teacher, and those who played for him never argued with that characterization. Have you a John Wooden memory you'd like to share?
Oddly enough, the one I have most vividly is the memory of him finally losing an NCAA tournament game in 1974 in Greensboro against David Thompson and North Carolina State after his Bill Walton-led UCLA team had blown, and I'm going by memory now, an 11-point lead in the last 4 minutes of regulation and a 7-point lead in the first overtime, and he didn't look any different than he would have had UCLA won by 50.
We don't know whether the Blackhawks or the Flyers will win the Stanley Cup. Philadelphia won Game 4 last night to tie the final series at 2 games apiece. But what does seem apparent is that more people are paying attention to the finals than in previous seasons.
Well, you've got a couple of brand names, you've got a couple of very big cities, and you've got a really good series so far. I mean, again, you're talking about NBC having a 2.8 overnight rating, which is not tremendous, but a great improvement for the NHL.
Umpire Jim Joyce's bad call that deprived Detroit pitcher Armando Galarraga of a perfect game on Wednesday night will not be reversed, so saith the commissioner, despite the gnashing of teeth by talk radio hosts coast to coast. Good decision?
And bloggers, I would point out at the Boston Globe. No, give Bud Selig an occasion to rise to, and he will fall on his butt out the window. Reverse the call. It harms no one. And as you know, Bill, there are several categories of stupid that I have to deal with in my career. But baseball stupid is right at the top of the list. The notion that because Galarraga and Jim Joyce both acted impeccably in the aftermath, and therefore as a lesson to the kids, we should allow an obvious injustice to stand because that's just the way baseball is. That's baseball stupid to the nth degree. Change the call. Do the right thing. It hurts no one.
Last Saturday, Roy Halladay of the Phillies tossed his perfect game against the Florida Marlins. It was unmarred by bad calls. However, there are those who feel the Marlins have cheapened the achievement this week by selling unused tickets to that game. For serious money, do you applaud or condemn their entrepreneurial efforts?
Do you get the feeling that the Marlins are really like Joe's Marlins Professional Baseball and Auto Body Repair? This is the cheapest thing I've ever heard. Look, a perfect game means a lot to the guy who throws it. It means a lot to the team employing the guy who throws it. It means a lot to the fans of the team of the guy that employs the guy who threw it. It means a lot to baseball fans in general. You know what it means to the team that lost? You really stunk that day. You were awful. You were humiliated. You were beaten as badly as a baseball team can be beaten. Stop selling off the bones of your disaster.
You seem to be suggesting that it doesn't mean anything to people who pony up a couple hundred bucks for a ticket they can no longer use because the game's over.
Well, that means those people are idiots, and you shouldn't lower yourself selling relics of the True Cross to a bunch of morons.
Elsewhere in baseball news, Ken Griffey Jr. decided on Wednesday night that he would retire, the least surprising retirement at least this season in baseball. No fanfare, just a simple statement. Care to put his 22-year career in perspective for us?
Well, I'll tell you, he had the most beautiful swing I've ever seen post-Ted Williams. He was always personable. He had a great smile. He hit 600 home runs. He might well have hit 800 home runs if he hadn't gotten hurt. He could have been Willie Mays. He didn't quite get there, but then again, maybe nobody ever will.
Charlie, I've put off talking about the third jewel in the Triple Crown, the Belmont Stakes, which will be run this afternoon, because the winners of the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness will not be present, and the favorite is named Icebox. Was ever a racehorse so inappropriately monikered Icebox?
Why, just because he won the Florida Derby?
I think Icebox. I don't know about you. I think Fast.
Would you have preferred, like, Meat Locker or Glue Factory? He's not going to win anyway. First dude's going to win, so...
And finally, Charlie, Stanley Cup fever has inspired a competition of sorts among Philadelphia's bakers. Which would you prefer to take a bite out of? The 40-inch-high Stanley Cup covered with over 1,000 pieces of tasty cake and other treats, or the 34-pound, 3-foot-tall exact replica Stanley Cup cake covered in fondant?
Pardon me?
I don't know either.
isn't he playing defense for the Flyers? I got to tell you, I got to go with the Tasty Cake just so I can say Tasty Cake.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and I hope we get some letters telling us what fondant is. Anyway, he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
I'm very fond of you, Bill.
cups and cakes, oh, what good things Mother makes. You've got to take tea, won't you take it with me? What a gay time it will be.
When Tiger Woods doesn't win, who does? And how do they handle the ensuing embarrassment of riches? Those were the questions that provoked John Feinstein to write a book about the 2003 golf season, during which Tiger Woods was tinkering unsuccessfully with his swing and won none of golf's four major tournaments. John Feinstein joins me now from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, great to be back. Thanks very much.
From 2000 to 2002, Tiger Woods won half the majors, 6 of 12 to be precise, set the stage for Moment of Glory by reminding us of what happened to prevent that run from extending into 2003.
It really began on the practice tee at the 2002 British Open, which was at Muirfield in Scotland. Tiger had made the decision to fire his longtime swing coach, Butch Harmon. Butch Harmon saw it coming, anticipated it as far back as the U.S. Open, which Tiger had won at Bethpage Black on Long Island. And sure enough, Tiger walked onto the tee, the practice tee, and said, "I'm fine this week, Butch. I'm okay." And that was the end of a 10-year relationship. And at that point, as you said, Tiger had won actually 7 of the previous 11 majors through the middle of 2002. And that started a string, when he fired Butch, of not winning any of the next 10 majors. And that opened the door for the four guys that I focus on in this book to win majors in 2003.
The first of the relatively unknown players to take advantage of the temporary decline of Tiger Woods was Mike Weir, who won the Masters in 2003. In one of the chapters about that triumph, you surprised me a little bit by writing, quote, "Cue the syrupy music." What inspired that?
Well, I mean, if you watch the Masters on television, it's full of syrupy music and syrupy phrasing and a tradition like no other. And they use all these silly terms. Fans become patrons, and the front nine is the first nine, and the rough is the first cut. If you can't make fun of the people at Augusta National, life just isn't worth living.
At the U.S. Open that year, Jim Furyk began his Sunday round 10 strokes ahead of Woods, and there were 24 players between those two, and yet you report that NBC's primary plot line that morning had Woods shooting a 60 or a 61 to win the tournament. How does a player like Furyk feel about that approach to televised golf?
Players have come to accept that. And Tommy Roy, the NBC producer of that U.S. Open, was very honest about it, that that was his fantasy, that Tiger was going to be teeing off just as their telecast began. He was going to get on a birdie roll. He was going to shoot a record score and somehow get himself back into the tournament, and the ratings would soar. And, of course, that didn't happen. Tiger went the other way, and Furyk won going away. But I think the story that Mike Weir's caddy, Brennan Little, tells about that year's Masters, when Tiger was 11 shots back of Mike Weir after 36 holes and barely made the cut when they cut the field in half after 36 holes, and one of the other caddies walked over to him with Mike Weir leading Tiger Woods by 11 shots and shook his head and said, "Well, Brennan, I thought you had him there for a minute."
My favorite story among the tales of the winners of the four majors in 2003 concerns Ben Curtis at the British Open. On the night before the final round, his wife asked him what he thought would happen the next day, and Curtis, who had never even played in a major before, let alone won one, said, "I'm going to win." Ms. Curtis was, I gather, somewhat surprised.
Stunned, I think, is the word. And if you know Ben Curtis at all, you can see why she would be. He's a very quiet, unassuming Midwestern kid from Ohio. The night before that British Open began, when he introduced himself to Mike Weir and congratulated him on winning the Masters, Mike Weir said to him, "Oh, thanks so much. What brings you over here?" He didn't even know Ben Curtis was a golfer.
To Mike Weir's credit, when he realized that Ben Curtis was, in fact, a fellow pro on the tour, he did apologize for that.
Mike tells that story, and he tells it in the context of how embarrassed he was. And, of course, Ben's response was, "Well, why should he know me? I was playing on the Hooters Tour a year earlier, which isn't even AAA golf. It's AA golf, two levels below the PGA Tour. And Ben was just a rookie. He'd only played in 13 golf tournaments on the tour by then, so his attitude was, why should anybody know who I am?"
I don't want to leave Sean McKeel out of the quartet of winners. He won the PGA Championship in 2003. Part of your project in this book was to discuss the impact of winning a first major on each of these golfers. How has Sean McKeel fared since that autumn 7 years ago?
Of the four, he has by far struggled the most, particularly on the golf course. He's had injuries, shoulder surgery. He had a testosterone deficiency issue, which was diagnosed just as the PGA Tour was starting to drug test. And for a long time, the tour wouldn't allow him to take a doctor-prescribed testosterone pill to overcome that. So he was constantly feeling sapped of energy when he played golf. So he's really struggled. And in 2009, he lost his exemption as a fully exempt player to play in any tournament he wanted to on the PGA Tour. His five-year exemption for winning the PGA Championship was over, and he didn't make the top 125 on the money list at the end of 2009, so he actually had to go back to qualifying school as a major champion.
John, you also write about various players in Moment of Glory who almost won majors in 2003, guys who either weren't quite good enough or who suddenly inexplicably played a couple of holes badly when even playing moderately well would have landed them in the headlines. Which of those stories was the most difficult to research and write?
Oh, I think the most difficult was Len Matisse, someone I knew well, who lost the Masters in a playoff to Mike Weir. Played one of the great Sunday rounds in the history of the Masters, shot 65, but bogeyed the 18th hole and has never contended in a major and is completely off the tour right now, back playing on the Nationwide Tour, which is the AAA level of golf. And just a tough story because he was so close to having that imprimatur of Masters champion for the rest of his life and came up literally inches short.
All these guys, whether they won a major or almost won a major, seemed to me they said to you, "I'm just doing this so that I can get back to what it felt like that time when I won or when I almost won." It's almost like chasing that first high if you're a drug addict. I mean, maybe that's an inappropriate...
Or maybe your second high, Bill, because you've experienced the first one.
Yeah, yeah.
And beyond that, to prove that the one time wasn't a fluke. There are a lot of guys, very good players, Fred Couples, Davis Love, Tom Kite, Lanny Watkins, to mention a few, who've only won one major, who are considered great players. So there's no fluke involved, but these guys want to prove that it wasn't just one week in their lives, that they're better than that, that they could do it again.
How did the Mike Weirs and Ben Curtises of the world feel when, shortly after 2003, Tiger Woods returned to form?
Well, probably like everybody else, he's back. And I don't think anybody was shocked. I think it's much different than the circumstances now where Tiger has basically blown up his life and is trying to find some salvation through golf. Back then, he had only blown up his golf swing. And everybody knew that sooner or later, he was going to figure it out again. As you said, in 2005, he started winning majors again and won six more until through the U.S. Open in 2008. He hasn't won since then, obviously.
The Pro Golf Tour currently seems, at least to me, to be in a state that somewhat resembles 2003, lacking a dominant Tiger Woods, who incidentally said on Wednesday that he wasn't seeking a swing coach, which is a nice hook for your book, as a matter of fact. But how long
Tiger
is this...
will do anything to help me out.
I'm sure of it. How long is this Tigerless state likely to last?
I don't think there's any way for any of us, including Tiger, to really know. He played very well at the Masters when he finished tied for fourth after a five-month layoff from competition, and then played very poorly in his next two tournaments. He's only played, going into the week at the Memorial, 9 competitive rounds on the year, which means he will have played 13 going into the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. He dominated the last time the Open was at Pebble Beach. He won by 15 shots, which is unheard of in any kind of golf tournament, much less a major championship. So if he's going to find his game again, his magic touch, Pebble Beach and St. Andrews, which is where the British Open is going to be, where he's won twice, are places where you would expect him to find it if he's going to.
John Feinstein is the author of a great many books about golf and various other sports, most recently Moment of Glory, which is published by Little Brown. He joined me from the NPR studios in Washington. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks again. Always a pleasure.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Jack Flagler is our intern. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Boston Globe columnist Bob Ryan.
Bill Littlefield is all a tingle as we are 1 week away from the start of the world's greatest sporting event.
All a tingle. Yeah, I guess that sums it up. But who knew Bob Ryan would acknowledge next week's Tour of Switzerland cycling race as the world's greatest sporting event? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. And the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.